Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network, Larry Mehler. And today we have UW-Madison Arboretum Director Karen Oberhauser joining us. We'll talk with her about the history of the Arboretum, research that's being done, and the signs of spring that you can see there. Maybe talk a bit about butterflies as well, because she's a butterfly expert. Are you a fan of the Arboretum or the Arboretum in your area? Why do you go? What are some of your favorite arboretums and botanical gardens? I hope you'll join in. Number to call 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Karen Oberhauser, welcome. Thank you for coming back and being with us again.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be back and fun to be talking about the Arboretum.
Yeah, I'm wondering how COVID-19 is affecting operations at the Arboretum.
Well, our visitor center is closed down, but just like the state parks in Wisconsin, which we just heard about, we're open to visitors and we're having lots of people coming to gain some comfort and get some exercise, and we're promoting public health recommendations, but we're hoping that people find some comfort in going to the Arboretum. And it's been nice going over there and seeing people staying safe distances apart, and they seem to be really enjoying it.
Yeah, and there's plenty of room over there. I've been there, I don't know, hundreds of times. And there's lots lots of room to roam there. How big is, how many acres do we have in that Arboretum?
Well, we have 1,200 acres in the Arboretum in Madison, and there are 17 miles of trails. So you're right, that provides a lot of space for good social distancing.
Well,
it's great.
Let's talk about the history of this Arboretum. It's a very rich history. How did it come to be?
Well, there was a big interest in the early 1900s of people in Madison in having some land that was set aside for both public use and for research. So there was, it's a great example of town and gown connections, because leaders in the city of Madison contacted the regents of the University of Wisconsin and talked about having an arboretum, land that could be used by the university and the public. And finally, in 1932, the first land was purchased. There are 246 acres purchased in 1932. And then in 1934, when the arboretum was dedicated, we had 500 acres of land. And over the next few decades, more and more land was both purchased and donated until we got up to the 1,200 acres that we have right now.
It's really an amazing place. Arbor, if I'm not mistaken, is in Latin means tree. Am I right there? I think.
You are right there. And it's interesting because when people think of an arboretum, they usually think of trees, because a lot of people know that connection to the word arbor. And we do have lots of trees, and we have kind of a...
Oh, we lost you for a second there.
Oops, sorry about that. Am I back now?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah, the Longenecker Horticultural Garden is more like a traditional arboretum, like you would see in other arboreta throughout the world. But we have the vast majority of our land is actually natural areas that are meant to represent natural ecosystems in the state of Wisconsin. So we have our garden areas and we have the natural habitat.
And an arboretum is, I think they're... I was trying to remember, you have three sort of missions, do you not?
Mm-hmm.
One of them, well, talk about the missions.
Okay, so our mission really has three areas. So we promote ecological research. So we're a research center at the University of Wisconsin, housed in the Office of the Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education. So we do a lot of research that's connected to ecology in general, restoration ecology, a lot of looking at interactions between organisms and different kinds of habitats. Our second, well, all three are really equal pillars, I think.
Yeah.
So we have research, we have conservation and restoration of arboretum land. So we use what's known about the best management practices for managing natural land, practice those practices on our land. And we foster the land ethics. So we have a strong outreach and education mission. And really that is focused on promoting connections between people and the natural world.
And, you know, I think I said in my introduction that the Arboretum has the oldest restored prairie in the world.
We do. So starting in the late 1930s and through the 1940s, people thought we'd like to represent the leaders of the Arboretum, thought we'd like to represent all of the ecosystems in Wisconsin, and a really important ecosystem in southern Wisconsin and western Wisconsin were native prairies. So starting in the 30s and through the 40s, basically we built a prairie, and that's Curtis Prairie. And as far as we know, we can rightly claim that this is the first restored prairie in the world. And then Green Prairie was started soon afterward. That's the prairie in the Grady Tract, which is south of the Beltline. So we have two really prime examples of what we can do to rebuild what was lost.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing. I love that prairie, and I love looking out on it at all times of the year. It's beautiful, isn't it?
It is just gorgeous. Yeah, it's a real privilege to work there and be able to walk out anytime through that prairie. And if I take a little longer walk, I can get down to Green Prairie as well. They're both amazing.
Talking with Karen Oberhauser today, she is the director of the UW Arboretum in Madison. It's great to have her with us. Questions for her? Maybe a comment. What's your favorite part of the Arboretum? What would you like to know about its history, perhaps? How do you use the Arboretum or the Botanical Gardens in your area? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we have lots of wonderful, I was trying to think about the arboretums that we have in the state. We have UW-Madison, there's the Oro Rice Arb in Delavan, I think, and then Milwaukee Rotary has an arboretum as well. And the difference, I think, and part of the difference between at least some botanical gardens and arboretums is that the arboretum has, as a prime pillar, research. And what's the, could you talk a little about the research that's going on in the arboretum?
Sure. We have, we issue permits. So everybody that is doing research in the arboretum, we know about it because we have permits to carry out this research. And just to kind of give you an idea of the magnitude of, or the amount of research that goes on in 2019, we issued 81 different research permits. So lots and lots of researchers. And this includes class projects. So undergraduate class projects where they're required to do a research project. A lot of UW faculty do research at the Arboretum. Graduate students, postdocs, people from other universities, the DNR. So there's lots and lots going on, and we kind of think of that as research that's being conducted by Arboretum staff and research conducted by other people. And it's just great to see. I mean, we have people studying interactions between ticks and the environment, people looking at frogs and toads and plants, so prairie-fringed orchids, and looking at interactions between dragonflies and mercury and pollination of plants. So you name it, it's probably going on at the Arboretum.
Well, let's take some calls. James in La Crosse has something first. Let's go there. Hi, James.
Hey. Say, my favorite thing at the Arboretum is the American chestnut trees. And I wondered if you knew anything about the commercially available hybrids or such that are for sale even in Wisconsin now?
Well, I'm not a chestnut expert, and you'd have to have our Longenecker curator, David Stevens, on to talk to you in detail about that. But you're right that we do have several chestnut specimens, and I know from David that our chestnuts are healthy at the Arboretum, possibly because they're well isolated from other trees, so there hasn't been the transmission of any diseases. But you'd have to ask David about the details of the hybrid chestnuts that are coming online.
You know, you should, you have a website, do you not, Karen?
Mm-hmm. We do have a great website.
I was thinking James could, I'm sure there's a place for contacts. Maybe James could even post a question on the website, and David would be able to answer. And it wouldn't hurt to have David on sometime to talk about that.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, he knows every tree. There are 6,000 specimens, and it's just amazing to walk through the garden with him and hear the story of every single tree and shrub growing there.
Oh, man. Yeah, we'll have to have him on. So at least in the immediate, James, you could check in with David through the – what's your website address again?
It's arboretum.wisc.edu.
I think we have it posted. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very easy to send a question to our info@, and that'll get forwarded to the right person to answer the question.
James, thank you so much. Johnny in Madison will go to you now. Hi, Johnny.
Yes, my question to your guest is, I'm a lifelong resident of Madison, and just driving on the Beltline, I've noticed that the trees seem to get thinner and thinner. I'm wondering if there's one of those happy little trimming people that likes to cut trees down and make it open so people can see. If what the reason is for that, I've noticed different other areas of the forest, too, that they've trimmed down. I don't know if somebody just liked the clearing of there or what the story was. If you could answer that for me, I'll listen off the phone. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Sure. That's a great question, Johnny. Thanks for that. So we have been doing a lot of tree clearing lately. And that's connected with another huge project that's going on at the Arboretum right now. And we actually have a pretty visible gap now in that tree area between the Curtis Prairie and the Beltline. And that's because we're doing some rehabilitation of an important stormwater pond that's in the southern part of Curtis Prairie. It's called Curtis Pond. And the Arboretum gets about 500 million gallons of water every year. That's enough to cover about 1,500 acres of land 1 foot deep. So it's an incredible amount of storm water that comes into the Arboretum. And that particular pond it's about 50 years old now, and it's been filling up with sediment that comes in with that storm water. And one of the things that needs to happen in order to fix that is that we need to convey water from under the Beltline into Curtis Pond, and it was done in an old, broken-down concrete flume. So what we're doing now is putting an underground conveyance, an underground pipe that'll take the water, and that meant that we had to do some clearing of trees. So that might be what Johnny was asking about. And also there's just natural aging going on of some of the trees along the Beltline. So some of the trees that were planted there aren't necessarily species of trees that grow very well in our climate. And those trees are just aging. So there's some natural aging going on, and then more recently this clearing due to the Curtis Pond Rehabilitation Project.
Thanks again for that call. Karen Oberhauser, our guest today, director of the UW Arboretum in Madison, talking with her about the UW-Madison Arboretum, its history, and certainly looking forward to your questions. As we move along, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today. Natalie Guyette, our on-air producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the UW-Madison Arboretum today with our guest, Karen Oberhauser, directs the UW Arboretum in Madison. It's great to have her with us. questions for her, give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dawn in Thiensville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dawn.
Hello. I'm just kind of getting concerned throughout the state of Wisconsin when I travel and stuff, and I'm just wondering if there's a connection, if they've researched anything about the number of trees that are being cut and not replaced. I'm seeing a lot of the farm fields with the larger equipment coming in. They're cutting down the tree lines that were there with the smaller tractors and things. But I'm not seeing these trees replaced throughout the state of Wisconsin. So I'm wondering if we're decreasing our tree numbers or if anybody's paying attention to that or anything.
Sure. That's a really great question, Dawn. And I think it brings up the fact that the landscape is really changing. And that's been happening for a long time, really since European settlement here, that a lot of forests were cut down. Actually, if we look at the total amount of land that's covered with trees, in some areas, the amount of trees are increasing because what used to be prairies sometimes has encroachment of woody species. But I really agree with you that as you drive around and look in agricultural areas, there's been a lot of clearing of long fence lines, in old woodlots that used to be left there that people left because they wanted to have a source of wood for fire and other reasons. So definitely we are losing forests. We're losing all kinds of natural habitats, and it's really important to conserve what we have left and try to replace what we've lost. So kind of depending on where you are in the state, we're losing different kinds of habitat. But I've noticed the same thing, that it's really changing out there.
We lost you there for just a second. But
I'm here.
Okay. Oh, great. Well, yeah, and I was thinking about what some organizations are doing. There's a number of environmental organizations. I happen to be involved with the Tree City USA program, the Tree City Wisconsin program, and things like that, where people have recognized this and are trying to do something about it.
Right. There's a lot of habitat conservation and habitat restoration work going on, and that's something that we really emphasize at the Arboretum, that there are many different kinds of natural habitats, and all of them have value. So when you come to the Arboretum, we show you the kinds of trees that can grow in Wisconsin, other kinds of habitat. The native plant garden right around the visitor center has labeled plants and different habitats you can use with native plants that you can do in your yard, and then the bigger natural areas. So hopefully we provide an example that people can come and look at and see what's possible,
yeah,
especially right in the middle of an urban area.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
It is indeed amazing. Let's take another call. Phil in Wanakee, it's your turn. Hi, Phil.
Yes, hello. I just have to add on for that. My wife and I have planted over 3,000 trees on our property up in Jackson County. 700 of those are oak, so just to add on that. But what I'm asking about is jumping worms. What can you tell me about them?
We have no shortage of them in Madison, that's for sure, Phil.
No, that's for sure. So first of all, I just want to thank you, Phil, for planting all those trees. That's really great. And that's so exciting that you're doing that. Yeah, jumping worms. We're doing a lot of research on jumping worms at the Arboretum. We're both monitoring the spread of jumping worms. We have kind of the dubious honor of being the first place they were found in Wisconsin. We probably aren't the first place they were, but the first place they were found. So we're monitoring the spread of jumping worms in the Arboretum and coordinating monitoring projects throughout the state, so working with other UW-Madison researchers. And one of the things that researchers at the Arboretum are trying to look at is ways to control them. At this point, the best thing we can do is really focus on stopping the spread, which and understanding the impacts. But definitely they're a big concern at the Arboretum and for gardeners and people interested in native habitat throughout the state.
Thank you, Phil. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say that it's been, I think, as an ecologist, and I've been a conservation biologist my whole career, we learn a lot about the way the natural world works from studying invasive species like jumping worms, because we learn about why some species do well, what the impacts of one species on others, and what happens when we remove the natural controls. So we're learning a lot about natural communities, and especially communities of things that live underground like worms do from these jumping worms. But invasive species, while they're kind of scientifically interesting, have caused lots and lots of problems.
And again, Phil, thank you so much for calling. Stella in Sturgeon Bay will turn to you now. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I just wanted to share a couple things. One is when I'm a native Madisonian. I don't live there now, but I grew up in Madison. And when I was in elementary school, when I was a kid, it was a point of pride in Madison that Walt Disney, the Walt Disney film, The Vanishing Prairie, needed to film a prairie fire. And the only one that they could do was they came to Madison and they filmed the annual burning of the Curtis Prairie. And so that is immortalized in the film The Vanishing Prairie by Walt Disney. And the second thing was I was quite intrigued or reminded when you talked about all of the research that is done in the Arboretum. When I was in ninth grade, my biology teacher had a research project going on in the Arboretum that several of us students assisted him with. And I never was real clear about what it was, but it was something to do with how many leaves earthworms eat. And what he did was he had marked out, it was either square foot or square yard patches with string, and then all of the leaves that had fallen in those patches, we students took and we stapled little squares of tinfoil or foil to them. And then a number of months later, we came back and we could collect the little tinfoil, the little foil pieces that were stuck in the top of the hole where the earthworm had pulled the leaf down to eat it.
Ah, what a cool...
Yeah, that is so interesting. I wanted to comment, too, on that Disney film. It is a really wonderful recognition of the importance of the work going on at the Arboretum. And I love reading. I actually have never seen the Disney film, but I love reading about the history and how that was filmed. And I'm so happy to hear, Stella, that your ninth grade teacher brought you here to do this research project. I've actually worked with a lot of teachers and love working with students on worms. One of the things that researchers do to assess the kinds and amount of worms in an area is they'll mark out, or we can mark out an area, usually it's a quarter of a meter square, and what you do is mix mustard powder with water and then pour that mustard powder into the area, and all the earthworms under the ground right there are irritated by the mustard, and they come squirming out of the soil. And especially when the jumping worms come out, they're just kind of writhing around and you can see them jumping out. So there are so many great projects you can do with studying worms. And I haven't heard about the tinfoil one, but that sounds really interesting too. So it's great. You learned a lot there and you know more than most people do about earthworms because of that great teacher.
Yeah, and Stella, you did a great job of explaining it. That was a few years back. Your memory's pretty good.
Well, it clearly was a big impression in my life.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for calling.
I just wanted to quick say, Larry, that's one of the things that we really try to promote is having teachers come to the Arboretum. We work with a lot of teachers who bring classes to the Arboretum. And once the world gets back to normal, we really invite teachers to take advantage of all the great things that we offer for student groups. So sometimes teachers come on their own, but we also have a lot of great programming. So it's really fun to hear what Stella's class did.
Yeah, it really is. Thank you again, Stella. Appreciate it very much. We had a caller who couldn't stay online but wondered, how would the prairies have been different from 300 years ago?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, unfortunately, we don't have data from 300 years ago. We try to reconstruct what was there. There probably was a lot of human influence on prairies and other habitat because there were people living here 300 years ago. Native Americans used the prairies, and we think that they probably burned them deliberately. And that probably had some impact on the growth of woody plant species in the prairies. So we do know that when you reconstruct a prairie, so a prairie that is a restoration versus a native prairie, while we can bring in a lot of the plants, we never see, at least, you know, even in our very old restored prairie, Curtis Prairie, it's very difficult to get the amount of diversity that we find in a remnant prairie or one that hasn't been disturbed by people, where the plants are growing there naturally. So we have these remnant prairies that we can use as kind of benchmarks to tell us what might have been there 300 years ago. And we know that those prairies are much more complex and have a lot more happening. And one of the really exciting areas of research right now is looking at the microbial community underground. And we think that a lot of those soil microbes have very close relationships with plant species, and those often are lost when the land is used for other things. For example, agriculture, where pesticides are applied and where those plants are removed year after year. So that's one of the great areas of research that's going on right now. A big area in understanding prairies is the importance not just of the plants and animals that we see above ground, but all of the things that are going on below ground.
Oh, very good point. Jim in Denmark has something for us that kind of goes along with some of the things you were just talking about. Jim, hi.
Good morning, guys. Yeah, I have a prairie question, but first I want to just compliment you, Larry, because we have a chestnut tree growing in our woods that 10 years ago you had Mimi on from Reedsburg, and she invited the whole state to come and get some seedlings, so we did it. And it's one of the six we planted is a big boy now.
So. Oh, that's wonderful.
Thanks, Larry. Well, I just had a quick question for Karen, and two of them. One is, does the Arboretum cut buckthorn? Because it's a continuing problem in our woods to get out there and pull it. And my second question is about, we planted a prairie, we have a new prairie, and it was planted in an old cornfield. And in that cornfield was rough bluegrass. It's a low-growing grass, and my people are saying, oh, it's going to inhibit the prairie plants, the grasses and such. And I'm wondering, Karen, if you could give me the name of an expert, or if you know, should I spray this cold season grass, or would I be better just to let it get overgrown by the prairie grasses that are supposed to come up?
Okay. Yeah, so you had quite a few questions there, Jim. And first of all, it's neat that the interest in chestnuts, you'll definitely have to have David Stevens on. But first, I'll start with buckthorn. Yes, we do a lot of work at the Arboretum working to control buckthorn. If you've been there recently, it's definitely a problem that continues, and we're really focusing on maintaining our high quality areas, and then just kind of as we can with with human capacity moving into the areas. But we have lots and lots of volunteers who are involved in cutting down buckthorn. I just want to send a shout out to the thousands of people, thousands of hours that get contributed every year to help the Arboretum control invasive species and do a lot of other work. So, yeah, I have spent my share of time working on buckthorn in many different areas and have calluses on my hands to prove it. So, yeah, we definitely work on buckthorn and other invasive species as well. Honeysuckle, there are just lots and lots of them. In terms of controlling cold season grasses in prairies, that is one that if you talk to a dozen prairie experts, you'll get a dozen different answers. And, you know, it's the use of herbicides to control weeds, basically weeds in prairies, is something that some people really don't want to do. They don't want to be involved with the use of herbicides. I can tell from personal experience that it's really difficult to start a prairie in an area that has a lot of invasive species pressure without using herbicides. So, you know, if somebody has a lot of time and a lot of people and maybe a pretty small prairie, it's possible to do it without herbicides. And the prairie enthusiasts do a really great job. I've been on a lot of prairie enthusiast land where they don't use very many herbicides at all and just burn a lot and really keep seeding. So what you need to do is increase the amount of competition that these invasive species, the cold season grasses and all the other invasive species that might come in. So if you can get the native plants established, you can minimize the use of herbicide. But, you know, herbicide is one of the tools in our arsenal. You know, I'm not just saying the Arboretum, but our meaning everyone who's involved in prairie restoration. It's one of the tools we use, and everybody has qualms about using a lot of herbicides. You know, they're not good for the environment, they're not good for people, but in some cases, it is a tool that we definitely rely on.
Yeah. Thank you, Jim, for calling, and thanks for that great story about the chestnut trees. It always feels good to know that shows that we do have direct results to those who listen. So thank you so much for that call. Stephanie in Beaver Dam, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to address an issue that was mentioned a few calls back. It was regarding trees in the hedgerows.
Yes.
And between farm fields.
Yeah.
So what I've learned is that all these small family farms are being bought up by the CAFOs, and because they want to connect their fields, they're taking out the tree rows, they're taking out the hedgerows, because they've got their big machines. They don't need to take a break in the shade anymore, and they want to connect all their feedlots for corn and all the other feed food that they're planting for the CAFOs.
Thanks for calling. I appreciate your call. And farm sizes and so forth have increased a lot over the years. Probably something that, I don't know if Karen, if you know any much about that.
Yeah, like the other caller said, I agree. I'm watching the same thing happen. And, you know, I think what we need to think about in terms of those kinds of impacts is we need to understand the problems that are caused. We need to understand the magnitude of the losses of natural habitat that we're experiencing and do all we can to slow it down and restore in areas that we still have control over. So yeah. I share your concern there, Stephanie.
Let's take, and I would just say in somewhat in response also, I know some family farms that are family farms, but they've gotten a lot bigger, some of them 1,000 acres where, you know, and so forth. So they're not necessarily large corporate farms, but a lot, probably most, are family operated in one way or another. It still doesn't take away the issue that Stephanie raised, for sure. Well,
yeah, and I think just one really important issue there is that there are a lot of really great examples of organic farms and smaller farms that are really doing a great job in maintaining natural habitat mixed in with the farming. And I think, you know, if we find out about those kinds of farms and supporting those, if it's possible for people, that's a great way to go too.
Yeah. Wayne in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning. I wasn't going to really talk about what you're talking about now, but I noticed that coming from Green Bay, we have a transportation company. We travel from Green Bay to Milwaukee quite a bit. A lot of those trees along that road are ash, and a lot of them have died in the last few years, more so down by Milwaukee and heading towards Green Bay and less towards Green Bay. But a lot of those fence rows are just simply ash that are dead in that fence row. And unfortunately, I die every time I see it myself. But anyway, that's what I see a lot of the changes as far as that goes.
Mm-hmm.
But I really called for how great I thought the Arboretum was when we've been there in the past in the spring when they had their plant sale. And I just tuned in about 15, 20 minutes ago, so I haven't heard if the plant sale is still on this year. I don't think it will be, but who knows? Maybe it'll be just later. But we bought a hummingbird and flower bed, or a hummingbird and butterfly flower bed guide when you go down to the plant sale. And about six years ago, I bought every plant you had on there, like two, three of them of each. And we bought a bunch of other stuff too, and it is absolutely amazing in our yard. We have 3 acres of woods, small area around the house that has sun. We have tons of shade plants, but we have one area that we have open for the butterflies and hummingbirds, and that's where we put this garden along the edge of the garage. Last year, we hung hummingbird feeders too, and you were talking about your mustard and water before, but we put cinnamon, you sprinkle cinnamon underneath your hummingbird feeders, and the ants don't go in your hummingbird feeder then, as long as it doesn't rain. Anyway, it's like an airstrip in our backyard. We counted 44 hummingbirds at one time, and 6 years ago, we'd only see one or two now and then. And honest to goodness, my daughter, I have a 10-year-old, and she thinks it's absolutely funny because she invites her friends over sometimes and she'll be like, watch the hummingbirds. And they literally are there all the time, and it's absolutely amazing.
Oh man, we're starting to run out of time, Wayne, but I thank you so much for that comment, and I'm sure, Karen, you have a comment.
Sure. Well, first of all, what a great story about the plant sale and all the hummingbirds in your yard, Wayne. They're some of my favorite birds. I love watching hummingbirds. And I never knew the cinnamon trick, so thanks for that. And I do want to say that one of the most heartbreaking decisions that we made with the COVID-19 issues is that we have, for the first time in 15 years, had to cancel the plant sale this year. We're hoping that it might be possible to get some of the people that pre-ordered plants to get their plants to them, but we have had to cancel that, and hopefully we'll be back full force. That's an amazing event. I've just loved attending it every year. So I'm glad that you got your plants and your butterfly and hummingbird plants, and hope a lot of other people out there did, but that's just a great event that the Friends of the Arboretum runs every year. And that's another amazing support group that we have at the Arboretum. And that event is wonderful.
And, you know, we were going to talk about butterflies a little bit today on the show, but we had lots of great questions and a great conversation, Karen. So I hope you will come back and be with us to talk about, because you do so much work with and have done so much work with butterflies, and we've talked with you about them in the past. So would you come back and talk about butterflies as well?
Sure, I would love to talk about butterflies. I'm always happy to talk about butterflies, but it's thrilling to talk about the Arboretum, too. So thanks a lot for having me on.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Karen. Karen Oberhauser is the director of the UW Arboretum in Madison. A delightful person, isn't she? It's so much fun to listen to her speak with such enthusiasm about her work and the work of all the others. I think she said there was something like 82 different research projects going on at the Arboretum. But you know what? It's always a nice place to go, and it won't be too long, maybe month or so, and the lilacs will be blooming there, and that's one of my favorite times to go because I love being there when the lilacs are in bloom. Well, we're going to turn our attention away from the Arboretum, but we're going to stay in the out-of-doors. And coming up next, we're going to be talking with you about the virtual Lakes and Rivers Convention and talk about lakes and rivers with you. Next on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mealer.